case myself. This is going to be quite informal and almost entirely empirical, and I sincerely hope that it won't last for more than an hour, because I think there's a feeling that some of us would like to do some real work. Okay, so these are in empirical studies on how energy usage relates to performance, using blow-fly retina as a model system. And John Anderson, Rob DeRuyter, and I realized some time ago that blow-fly retina, shown here, is a very good system for measuring information transfer, because essentially each photoreceptor is concerned with coding a single pixel in the image. There's no lateral interactions between photoreceptors within the retina, and so when you record the electrical signal from a photoreceptor, which is analog, this represents all the information for color, contrast, motion, form, whatever, that's going to come from this particular pixel.
I just asked people some ignorant question of ignorant now.
Yeah.
So one pixel corresponds to one magnitude.
Yes.
Can one magnitude resolve more than one and put more than one pixel?
Well, in flies it's rather complicated. Because it's a little more complicated because underneath each lens there are six photoreceptors. And the angle between, and they're independent waveguides, so they're separated. You'll see a picture later. And the fly is very clever. It makes the angle between the waveguides within an ommatidium equal to the angle between ommatidia, so that there are neighbors pointing in the same direction. And then the wiring from the photoreceptors brings together the eight axons in seven different ommatidia, because two photoreceptors lie one on top of the other, that are all pointing in the same pixel. So the fly then gets information about one pixel through seven lenses, which means it has a better signal-to-noise ratio. But so when I draw this, this is a sort of cartoon, which is sort of glossed over that, because it's, you really don't need to know that. It's a nice piece of neural engineering.
Perceptually,
these are all looking at the same point in space.
No, but I mean the resolution of the fly, like angular resolution.
Is set by the number of ommatidia. It is, yeah. So it really is one ommatidium per pixel, but the information from one pixel is gathered from seven ommatidia by this neat trick. So you put in pseudo-random white noise, intensity modulation, you record the analog signal, either in the photoreceptor or in the postsynaptic interneurons, which I'm not going to talk about, and you present the same pseudo-random sequence 100 times or 200 times and average them, and that gives you the average response to this sequence, and then you subtract the average away from each individual response, and that gives you the variations, the noise, and then you can simply take the signal-to-noise ratio of the power spectra and use Shannon's formula for Gaussian analog signal contaminated with Gaussian noise, and we show the noise is Gaussian, to get the information rate in bits per second. So it's very, very direct and elementary. And we think that this is a valid measure of the performance of this these neurons, or these photoreceptors and this neuron, because the data that's contained in these signals drives all the vision in the fly. It drives form vision, motion vision, color vision, and polarization sense. So consequently, a general measure of information about anything seems to be appropriate at this level. And that's very important, because I think it's always important to ask the question when you're using information theory, information about what? And why is my particular measure of information defined by the system that I've set up to measure it, why is it relevant to vision as a whole? So we can measure information rates, and one day it also occurred to me that we could measure the amount of energy that these photoreceptors were using to generate this information from photons. And the reason we could do that is because one of the great advantages of using fly photoreceptors is, as a model system, is that the molecular biology and biophysics of phototransduction in these cells has been worked out in a great deal of detail, in particular by Charles Zucker and Roger Hardy and a variety of molecular biologists, and Atty Bäckström and Mikko Yusler, and a whole gang of people have looked at these. And you can put all of this into a very simple cartoon, and it really is just a fraction, in fact, minuscule fraction of what we know about this system. Essentially, rhodopsin molecule, as in your own photoreceptors, absorbs a photon and triggers a second messenger cascade, just like your photoreceptors, only in this case, it's a IP3-based cascade. And this produces a signal, we're not quite sure what the signal is still, that gates light channels that emit sodium and a bit of calcium. So a photon causes the photoreceptor to depolarize in response to light, and the conductance goes up. There are also voltage-sensitive potassium channels in the membrane, which open in response to depolarization, and they act as a negative feedback, and they also improve the frequency response of the membrane. So they help the photoreceptor respond faster at higher light levels, because by opening more of these, you reduce the membrane time constant. Now, so as photons rattle in, sodium ions are entering the cell, and potassium ions are leaving. And if the photoreceptor is to carry on signaling, these ions have to be restored to maintain the concentration gradient that drives the electrical response. And Baumann in particular has shown that fly photoreceptors are richly endowed with sodium potassium ATPase molecules, which pump back the potassium and extrude the sodium with well-known stoichiometry of 3:2 for every ATP that's hydrolyzed to ADP. Roger Hardy has measured the reversal potential for sodium, and we've also measured the reversal potential for potassium. And with this very simple picture, we can generate a model of the membrane. Let's look at this bit down here, where you simply have a light-gated conductance, a potassium conductance, known reversal potentials, and a pump, electrogenic pump, with known stoichiometry. Three sodiums, two potassiums, I think, never get this right way around, but every ATP hydrolyzed to ADP. And if you know the combined these two conductances sum together, that's the total conductance of the membrane, you can solve this circuit to work out the steady state, light-gated and potassium currents, and therefore the pump rate in units of ATPs hydrolyzed per photoreceptor per second. And that gives you an estimate of the steady state energy consumption of the photoreceptor. I emphasize its steady state. So here we are. This is the energy required to keep the membrane potential at this average level corresponding to this average light intensity. And it's not taking account of these transients, which in R, although they contain all the information, the transients are relatively small and the time constant of the pump is long. So this really is a reasonable measure of energy consumption, but we probably should correct it slightly for capacitance. So what do we get? Well, what we find is that in bright light, a photoreceptor codes about 1,000 bits per second from this stimulus. And to do so,
did you see what the stimulus was?
It was Gaussian white noise with a contrast of about 0.2. Yeah. So it's coding about 1,000 bits per second. And the ATP consumption is 9 × 10⁹ ATPs per photoreceptor per second, which gives you a value of some close to 10⁷ ATP molecules per bit. Now that's a rather meaningless number in some ways, so what? Well, it's a long way from the thermodynamic limit. If you had a protein as a switch, you could phosphorylate it with one ATP, change its conformation, and signal a bit. It's a long way from the limit for two reasons. The first reason is, of course, the cell has actually had to convert a photon into a signal, and that requires extra energy. And the second thing is that the signal, unlike the protein, which is just here at one point, the signal has to be distributed in space. It has to be transmitted.
So this is baseline energy consumption.
This is baseline energy consumption, but depending on signal level. As you put more light in, the energy consumption goes up.
So it's a difference between baseline and the...
We'll come to that in a minute. This is the total energy consumption, baseline plus signaling. And later on, we'll separate out the two, I hope. Okay, that's a good point. In fact, it's the whole point of the talk. So, information seems to be very expensive. And if you convert the energy consumption per photoreceptor into the amount of oxygen required to generate that ATP by metabolism, and you multiply up by the number of photoreceptors, you get a value which is about 8% of the resting oxygen consumption of the fly. So this really is big news for the fly's energy metabolism. It's a big drain in bright light. It's investing a lot in vision. And interestingly, I just reviewed a paper from a group in Slovenia, and I don't have pigeonholes for Slovak names, so I can't remember the names of the authors, who have measured the light-induced oxygen consumption in blowfly photoreceptors using an amazing technique, because it's in sort of nanoliters of oxygen per second. And their measurements are almost exactly the same as our estimates, which must be a fluke, but at least we're in the right ballpark. Okay. So another reason why information is so expensive in the photoreceptor is that the photoreceptor has really invested a lot to bring its rate up to 1,000 bits per second. And the reason for that is that if you have a system that is limited by signal-to-noise ratio, then the information capacity is going as the log of 1 plus the signal-to-noise ratio, but the cost is, and the signal-to-noise ratio goes as the number, square root of the number of photons, and the cost goes approximately as the number of photons.
So I'm afraid I'm lost, so I think it's...
I think I need to do the chore.
Not that particular point, but just, I thought from what you said before that the cost was basically proportional to the meaningless, which can't be any predictor of the bit rate, which is proportional to the variance limits. You said you were going to get to that, but now you're trying to equate
the
bit rate with the cost.
So where's the light's over here somewhere, isn't it? It's here. Right. You'll see this in a minute, but if you just take the simple form of Shannon's equation, it's just easier to write down, then these responses are noise limited. But the information rate of the photoreceptors goes up with light level, even though the stimulus contrast remains the same, because you have more photons, so the signal-to-noise ratio gets better. It also improves because they open these potassium channels and improve the bandwidth. So here we have photons. And so the system is noise limited. And I'll show you data on that later. And if you have a noise-limited system, then the cost is going to go up as the number of signaling particles, here photons, that you're using. But the information rate goes up much more slowly as a function of the cost, which means that the cost per bit increases as you increase the bit rate of the system.
I'm not sure why the cost has to be proportional to the number of photons, because each one is transduced into, you know, millions of ions that flow across the membrane. Why couldn't you change that gain?
Well, the gain does change. So, okay. But over six orders of magnitude, the gain change is smaller. And we'll see that as well. So this is a very general argument. This is the sort of, this is the basic bottom line argument, that if you want to increase your information, let me put it a different way. If you want to increase your information rate in a single neuron or a single photoreceptor, you can do it in this analog system in two ways. You can increase the bandwidth, which they do, in which case the time constant is going to improve roughly in proportion to the conductance. And this will not change the cost per bit. If you double the conductance, you double the cost, but you halve the time constant, double the bandwidth, so it's the same unit cost. But if you're playing the game of increasing the signal-to-noise ratio, there's a highly non-linear relationship between cost and transmission rate, which penalizes high rates achieved by high signal-to-noise ratios. And in our paper, which is now ancient history, we illustrated this by looking at the synapses which connect the photoreceptors to the interneurons, and we knew the signal-to-noise ratio of every synapse on average, and we could simply add up the synapses, add more of them to the system, so here we are increasing on this non-linear scale the number of synapses. This increases the bit rate according to an increase in the number of synapses, so we're assuming the bandwidth is constant, but it also increases the cost per bit. So one reason that information is expensive in these photoreceptors is they have evolved to achieve high bit rates. And that means that information is going to tend to be expensive. So this suggests that the cost of information is going to scale somehow with bit rate in these cells. And you can think of two components of the cost of generating the signals and the resting cost of having the photoreceptor there not doing anything.
So again, what would happen if the photoreceptor wanted to have a 10 times lower average current across its membrane? Like what would that do to its performance?
Well, in bright light, they seem to be operating close to having one channel per photon. And if you go below that, you lose quantum efficiency.
One channel per...
opened per photon. It may be two, but it's around that level. In dim light, they increase the gain, presumably to boost the signal up so that it can sort of get over intrinsic noise in the system.
Right, so.
Yeah. So the penalty for reducing your conductance would be, in the bright light, would be that you would transduce fewer photons. And you would lose signal-to-noise ratio, either because you would try not to saturate and you would adjust the system so that the quantum efficiency doesn't fall. And that puts a limit on your quantum efficiency.
So you're saying in dim light it's the photon shot noise that's limiting, or is it in dim noise?
In dim light it's the photon shot noise that's limiting, and in bright light it's the number, it's the capacity of the photoreceptors to transduce.
So what is the bandwidth of them?
The bandwidth of these cells is rough, is... whoops. So The voltage signal has a 3 dB cutoff point at around 75 Hertz. And the membrane has a cutoff around 150 or 200 Hertz. And phototransduction, the dynamics of the phototransduction cascade, they have a cutoff that's much closer to the final light response, around 18 Hertz or something. So for photoreceptors, that's quite fast. And if you warm them up to 32 degrees centigrade, which isn't an unreasonable temperature for a fly, the bandwidth goes up to about 150, 140 Hertz. And the whole light response is completed within about 3 milliseconds, 4 milliseconds, which makes them one of the outside of synapses, one of the fastest second messenger systems we know. And if you look inside the photoreceptor, you discover that all of the photoreceptor membrane is made up of microvilli, little outgrowths which contain the photopigment. And within each microvillus, all of the components of the phototransduction cascade are arranged on the cytoskeleton. And it's thought that this is somehow connected with making a fast response. So these flies, they've really evolved for speed, but they pay a big cost. Okay, so you've asked lots of interesting questions about really.
So could we ask one more?
Yeah.
Of course, invertebrates, everything's backwards. Is there, light causes the ion flow to shut off?
Yes.
Do you have any? Is there anything good about that in terms of energy?
I can't. I can only think of one thing that's good concerned with energy. The old argument was that, well, because you're closing channels with light, it must be more economical. This, for cones, is fallacious, because to maintain your quantum efficiency, you must have one channel event per photon. So the rate of opening and closing must be equal to the photon rate, which means the light-gated conductances, if the channels have roughly the same conductance, actually cones manage to block their channels, so probably a bit more economical. But if they have the same conductance, the cost is the same. So then you have the rods, which are turned off during the day, and so that makes it seem more economical, but on average it's dark as long as it's light. And the only advantage that one can think of is one that was actually suggested by Alan Hodgkin, which is that during the day, the ganglion cells and bipolar cells and amacrine cells of the retina are much more active. And by shutting off the rods, you free up some energy for the more vigorous neural processing that's going on in the rest of the retina. And that's the only advantage that anybody's been able to think of. And everybody's casting around for, why microvilla or rhabdomeric photoreceptors have a different cascade. Nobody knows the answer.
Wait, I'm sorry, Sam. So what was the question? So the question, why is they go in reverse?
Yes, why is it reversed? Why do insects open and, rhabdomeric photoreceptors open their channels in response to light, and the ciliary photoreceptors of vertebrates close their channels in response to light?
So wasn't there an argument that you would want to have closing design if you wanted to increase the speed of response or something?
How does that come about? I haven't heard that argument.
So the idea is that, I'm not sure I can say it quantitatively, but the idea is that if you want to do something quickly, you have to be ready to do it.
Yes, I see. So you want to have a high background level, and then you need it, that background level has to be high so that you can get a lot.
In engineering, that's a common situation. So you're basically paying for readiness.
Yeah. Well, it sounds good, but it doesn't work. I mean, at least it doesn't seem to work in the sense that insect photoreceptors, so these photoreceptors respond to single photons. And the counter argument is that if you have a photoreceptor that's got its lowest conductance in the dark, then you'll get the largest voltage event for a given number of channels that you open, so you'll have a high gain. And it turns out that the insect photoreceptors in the dark tend to be much faster than many rods are in the dark. So, yeah. It's interesting to speculate on, and there could be a neat answer, but nobody's got there yet. Okay, but you've all raised lots of interesting questions about, you know, how does cost really depend on light level? How far does, you know, interesting questions of neuroeconomics. So we set about trying to answer this by doing a comparative study. Thank you. And what we've done is compare photoreceptors of three different sizes. So as I was saying, flies have 7 photoreceptors under each lens. 6 large ones called R1 to 6 form a ring around the outside. So you probably can't see this. It's probably a wonderful example of that you tell your students not to put up things that look like this. But anyway, there are 6 large photoreceptors and 1 smaller one in the middle. So here we are, cut it in cross-section. That's 2 microns. This is the photosensitive part, and these photoreceptors here, R1 to 6, all have the same photopigment, and they go into the achromatic pathway. And then there's a smaller pair of photoreceptors, R7 and R8, which code color and polarization, and they sit one on top of each other. So when you cut a section through, you only see one of them. And R7 is the larger one that we more frequently record from, so that's the one we'll be talking about. So here, within the blowfly califera, we already have photoreceptors of 2 different sizes. And if we go back to Drosophila, and Mikko Jussila developed very good techniques for recording from Drosophila photoreceptors, and Jeremy Nevin, who worked with Mikko, joined my lab and has made Drosophila photoreceptor recordings. So we can look at R1 to 6 in Drosophila as well. And this is the cartoon, shows you roughly their differences in size, where in this x-axis the scale is 80 microns, and in this y-axis the scale is 2 microns. And you can see that Drosophila photoreceptor is about 20% of the size of the Califera R1 to 6 of the same class, and Califera R7 is intermediate. So now we can ask 2 questions. Does the rate at which information is transmitted depend in any way on the size of these photoreceptors? And if it does, how does that influence the cost of information? So we just do the same old experiments. Only this time, we apply our white noise stimulus at a number of different backgrounds. And I should say that it's very important when you're making these comparisons that all of the photoreceptors that you're comparing are receiving equal numbers of photons. So what we do is dark adapt the cells and then put in a lot of neutral density filters, make a very dim light, and count single photon responses. So we know how many photons per second our stimulus is generating when it's very strongly attenuated, and then we simply take away the filters, and we know how many photons are available to the photoreceptor, and it's available to them at higher light levels. So here is Drosophila R1 to 6, Califera R7, Califera R1 to 6. We increase the light level logarithmically, and we measure the change in bit rate.
Excuse me, you used the word available to them. I'm curious why you chose that.
Yeah, I'll just come to that in a minute. You can see that up to about 10 to the 4 photons per receptor per second, they all have the same bit rate. That's because they're simply limited by the number of available photons. At higher light levels, they start to diverge. And you'll notice that Drosophila, even though it's been given more photons, its information rate remains constant. And that's because although those photons are available to it from the lens, it doesn't use them. These photoreceptors have pigment granules inside them that move up close to their photoreceptive waveguide and bleed the light out of it, and to prevent the photoreceptor becoming saturated.
Simon, at the very highest effective photons per second, is the system still linear? Because you're calculating the information rate.
You mean
rate.
Here?
No. You're calculating the information rate with Gaussian white noise.
Oh, we're still a long way away from saturation. So yes, the system is approximately linear for these contrasts. Oh yeah. So these very high light levels are the same light levels that we used in our earlier papers where we showed that the response was approximately linear. Yeah. So although these photons are available to Drosophila, it's not using them, because if it let those photons encounter visual pigment, it would actually saturate its transduction machinery. It simply doesn't have enough microvilli available to handle photons at this high rate.
Is pigment leaching a concern at all at these intensities?
No, because in the insects do something very much, vertebrate retina are so badly engineered in many ways. So the insects use photoreosomerization. So when the chromophore absorbs photon, goes into the all trans configuration and activates, it's sensitive now to absorption of the photon of a different wavelength, the longer wavelength. And so the second photon it absorbs flips it back. So in bright light, the ratio of rhodopsin to metarhodopsin only depends on the wavelength, because it's the difference between all the wavelength distribution. It's how many metarhodopsins it's the relative photon catches of metarhodopsin and rhodopsin from that light source to determine the balance. So we don't have to worry about bleaching, which is a nice.
How fast are these rates?
The photon absorption rates, noise analysis suggests that they're getting up to something like 10 to the 6th per photoreceptor per second in these big photoreceptors. And
but if the rate of excitation is balanced by the the transitions between rhodopsin and metarhodopsin are balanced in both directions and they're both proportional to intensity, you wouldn't get a signal anymore.
So back in 1987, Joe Howard and Barbara Blakesley and I did a study of blowfly photoreceptors where we increased the light level and saw what happened to the signal-to-noise ratio. And in the normal photoreceptors, you see something like that. And then we took a white-eyed mutant that had no screening pigment, so it didn't have these sunglasses that it can put on to stop saturation. And because the optics, there's lots of scatter in the eye, you can really pump in a lot of photons into these cells. And in the white-eyed mutant, the signal-to-noise ratio went up, and then it came down again, as you saturated all the transduction units. And we could estimate from that that this is a finite population of transduction units being activated, so the statistics should be binomial. And we could fit this signal-to-noise ratio with binomial statistics, and we could work out what n, the number of events that can be supported, are. And n turned out to be something like 50,000, which is quite similar to the number of microvilli. And it looked as if the wild type in daylight was getting up to this region here, which is the optimal signal-to-noise ratio for this distribution of signaling particles, if you like. which is about half of them being active at any one time. And that kind of agrees with the lifetime of quantum bumps. We think that these photoreceptors are transducing in the order of 50,000, maybe a bit more, photons per second, each event lasting about 2 milliseconds, and they're using about half their transduction units. So they're really rattling along. I mean, it's
okay. Like getting back to pigments, each microvillus has many pigment molecules.
Each microvillus has many pigment molecules,
okay,
so and the hypothesis is that the microvillus is acting as a transduction unit, is a morphological unit of phototransduction.
And a single pigment activated
pigment. It within that activates the channels in that microvillus, and then it has to recover in some way, and before that microvillus can operate again. So the photopigment is not saturated, it's the microvilli which are saturated, and the numbers from the saturation analysis support that. Right, so, I mean, our argument is very simple. Thanks for that question. Our argument is that the photoreceptors here in the Drosophila just have fewer transduction units. So their curve, the signal-to-noise ratio, would go like that. And as you increase the length and width of the photoreceptor, the number of transduction units goes up. And one of the things that we're now doing is a more wide-ranging comparative study where we can take, and we're doing EM to count the number of microvilli, and then we can see whether this really holds up or not. But our working hypothesis is that the information capacity that we measure here is limited by the number of transduction units. And I must say that somebody could help me here. I'm desperately looking for a good word, which means the ability of a cell to transmit information, its upper limit of its ability, that isn't information capacity, because information capacity has a very definite meaning in information theory, but it happens to be the piece of common speech which best explains what we're trying to do, which is the ability or the amount of information that neurons can carry as limited by their structure.
Throughput.
Well, but throughput could be at any... Anyway, so yeah, all please email all suggestions to me and I will buy a beer for the best one. Okay, good. Right. So this suggests that flies have bigger photoreceptors so that they can transduce photons at higher rates, and that bumps up their information capacity or ability or whatever, bumps up their maximum throughput. Yeah, maximum throughput, that's getting close. So we'll share the beer. So let's look now at the energy costs in these photoreceptors, which we can calculate in just the same way that I showed you for the blowfly. So this is the rate at which ATP is being hydrolyzed in 10 to the 9 ATPs per second, calculated for our model in the dark and at different luminances. And it's a log plot. And what you can see is that, surprise, surprise, the smallest photoreceptor draws the least energy. And as you get bigger, the amount of energy you draw goes up. And I think that's what any sane biophysicist would expect. What's interesting is that the consumption in the dark is, in fact, only is roughly a quarter of the steady state consumption in the brightest light. So it looks as if by making yourself into a larger cell, by having a larger cell, you impose a very large fixed cost on the cell. That this cell is chewing up ATP in the dark when it's not signaling. So this is a fixed cost of having a cell there without a signal. And as this cost here is about 8% of the resting oxygen consumption of a fly, this cost here is about 2%. So even in darkness, 2% of the resting oxygen consumption of a fly goes into its photoreceptors, and the reason it's high, we presume, is so that it can achieve this high inflammation capacity.
So Simon, one might wonder here, the small photoreceptors are so much more energy efficient, so why doesn't the blowfly build a bunch of smaller Ommatidia?
Well, I think it simply can't, because the if you have smaller Ommatidia, then the lens is worse. And so you actually have to have the information there in the first place. So small photoreceptors will get very little information per pixel, and if you give them small lenses, they get even less information. So actually what we're working up to is, we're going to, the other reason we're doing this, can I come back to that at the end? I'll come back to that at the end. Why have they made such big photoreceptors? Why don't they just stick with the small ones? Good question.
What is diffraction limit, right? Smaller photoreceptors have poorer resolution.
Exactly, yeah.
You still have to show efficiency of duration, right?
No, this is just cost. Yeah, this is the next. So these are, now we can compare these three photoreceptors operating at the same bit rate. And we can ask, well, what has the maximum throughput done to the cost per bit? And if you increase your maximum throughput, it makes information very much more expensive. And essentially, this is just the law of diminishing returns. You all know this when you buy an automobile. If you buy a Ferrari, it'll have much worse fuel economy than if you buy a Nissan Micra. And it'll be, so the Ferrari can go out here, can go really fast, but it'll still be chewing up a lot more fuel when you're going alongside the Nissan Micra on the freeway. So you can't simply say, I'll invest in this high capacity and I'll only be paying for it when I use it. You pay for it all the time, even in the dark. And this puts this increases the selective advantage in evolution of reducing your photoreceptors to just the right size that you need to survive.
Well, potentially, I mean, I guess maybe it's the cost information for the entire eye will be larger.
Well, it would, so
if you, right, the receptors are smaller, for larger eyes, the receptors get relatively smaller.
Ah.
So you have much finer resolution. So the total information,
no,
so bit rate per eye will be larger and larger eye.
So let's go back to here. So Drosophila has lenses like that. They're sort of what, 14 microns, something like that. And Calliphora has lenses twice as big, about 25 to 30 microns. And because the diffraction limit here is half here, the angle between Drosophila photoreceptors is at least twice as large as the angle between the Calliphora photoreceptors, which means that Drosophila not only has smaller photoreceptors.
That's not true, because it also depends on the size of the radius of the eye, right?
Yes.
And the diameter of Ommatidium scales the square root of the radius of the eye. So it should have a finer resolution, despite
This one?
Yeah.
This has much better resolution,
yeah.
But it has a much larger eye. The resolution is going as the square root of the radius. So you have to increase the radius four times to make twice the resolution. So I think I might have misunderstood. We might be saying the same thing.
No,
it isn't the case that if you had smaller photoreceptors in your eye, you necessarily have, you can have more of them from an optical point of view.
What I mean is the bit rate per eye would be higher in the larger eye.
Oh yes, it'll be much higher in the larger eye. And it would be even if they use the smaller photoreceptors, because they have more pixels.
So it may be that the, if I divide by, if you look at black curve, if I include the fact that I'm transmitting more beats per eye, it will go lower than the red curve. You know what I mean? So I need to divide, now to account for this effect, I need to divide black curve by the resolution of the eye. So the black curve may be lower than the red curve.
No, I don't think so, because I think that so your argument is that the bigger eye can go out to resolve finer details, so it has a better spatial boundary. And what we're measuring here is the information just in one photoreceptor, and we've given it a bandwidth which is much larger than the photoreceptor can handle in time. And I think that the ratio between the optical space point spread function, in fact I know that the ratio between the optical point spread function of the lens and the sampling density of the photoreceptors is constant among all of the advanced flies. They work at about half the Nyquist limit, which is a way of reducing redundancy, by the way. And because they have that same scaling, I think that argument actually all sort of drops out. But we could come back to it, because I'm very interested in it. So, why you'll see here a rather puzzling, initially seems to us quite puzzling curve, but the cost of information seems to be falling as the bit rate goes up, whereas my original signal-to-noise ratio model said it should, in fact, be going this way. One of the reasons it's falling is because the signaling cost is superimposed on this fixed cost. So when you lump all the costs together, then the first bit is incredibly expensive, because you're saying that the fixed cost is also contributing to the cost of the first bit. So we can simply separate out these costs and subtract away the fixed cost from the signaling cost, which I've done for the two proliferative photoreceptors here. And you can see that the signaling cost per bit is still very high at low luminances and then drops. And that may very well be because the gain of phototransduction is reducing as the cell light adapts. So up here, about 50 times as many channels are activated per photon as here. And that might go some way to explain that. But we can test that in these photoreceptors. And if you look at the signaling cost as a function of bit rate, you see that again, the bit cost is lower in the photoreceptor with the lower maximum throughput. So, this is a foray into a new field called, well, I wanted to call it neuroeconomics. So I thought I ought to find out whether anybody had used this term before, and I typed it into Google, and I found a site that specializes in collecting particularly useless and ridiculous terms that the scientific community had generated, and one of them was neuroeconomics. And so the real neuroeconomics is where people are put into functional imaging machines and asked to make economic decisions from game theory, because that's what business is all about, and you find out which bits of their brain light up when they're doing it. So that's neuroeconomics. This is something else. This is classical zoology in many ways.
Well, maybe that's macroeconomics.
Microeconomics. Okay, yeah, that's a good, yeah, this is neuro-microeconomics. Anyway, I'm sure if I said that, I'd be on that Google site. Anyway, then I could put that in my CV. So, information capacity increases the cost of information, mainly because of the requirement for a better signal-to-noise ratio in photoreceptors. They also have faster responses by reducing their time constant, and if the bandwidth, if the spectrum of the input signal was flat, that would have no effect on the cost per bit. But the spectrum's not flat, it falls off with frequency, so that's also going to increase the cost per bit eventually. So the general sort of take-home message for this is that there's a law of diminishing returns that seems to come from basic biophysics. And we fondly imagine that this law could generalize to neurons. Because one can ask the question, why do the big photoreceptors have to have such a large conductance in the dark? Why can't they just shut themselves down to the same level as the small photoreceptors? Well, you say they've got bigger membrane. Yes, but they could phosphorylate channels and things. And we think that our working hypothesis is that they have a high resting conductance because of dark noise in phototransduction. Now, this dark noise is very difficult to measure in insects, but we're beginning to develop ways of looking at it. And if you have dark noise, which is essentially noise being generated by your transduction units, your microvilli here, then this noise power is going to increase with the number of transduction units. And these light-gated channels are going to depolarize the cell, and if you want to keep your synapse poised in the right range, then you're going to have some potassium conductances to oppose this. Now, in support of this idea, if you look in photoreceptors at, here's a photoreceptor membrane potential in the dark, down here, can people see this, is EK, which is about minus 88, and the resting potential in the dark is up here at minus 65. So there is some large depolarizing conductance in these photoreceptors. It could be calcium channels of the photoreceptor terminal. It could be some conductance we haven't identified, but it could also be dark noise. And if it turns out to be dark noise, then this illustrates a principle that you can generalize to other neurons. If you want to increase the amount of information, if you increase the amount of information a neuron carries by increasing the numbers of channels or synapses that it's using so as to get a more reliable response, spontaneous activity in these signaling elements will increase your fixed cost, and that will increase the cost of information in that neuron, so providing a selective advantage for reducing neurons to the minimum size required to do the job. I mean, I'm sure we all believe that that's what neurons do, and it seems perfectly good common sense, but here is the glimmerings of a sort of biophysical rationale for it.
I mean, can you measure the dark noise by changing temperature?
This is dark noise, this is not spontaneous isomerizations. These are intermediates in phototransduction. So when Peter Lillywhite and I looked at locus photoreceptors, we found that the spontaneous isomerization rate was in the order of 5 events an hour, which made it rather difficult to work on and do the obvious experiments, because you'd need to estimate what KT was, you'd need 1,000 events, and that would take you 200 hours. We couldn't record that long. So
is that for the whole photoreceptor? Or?
That's for a single photoreceptor. And that insects haven't done anything clever with their photopigment. It's just that a toad rod contains an order of magnitude more photopigment than a fly photoreceptor, than a locust photoreceptor.
So in what regime is the dark noise limiting? High intensity, obviously not there.
No, it's not limiting.
Counting noise.
No, and
then at low intensities, doesn't the counting noise get worse and worse? At low intensities?
The dark noise, hold on.
No, just the Poisson noise.
The Poisson noise is limiting at low intensities, but we're talking about noise in the dark when there's no light at all.
Okay, that's low intensity.
No. That's really low intensity. And it looks very much like Baylor and Yao and Lam described for toad rods. That when you look at these photoreceptors in the dark, every so often you get a spontaneous event that looks just like a quantum bump. So that's probably a spontaneous isomerization. But the whole time there's this slightly higher frequency sort of rumbling going on. And that makes it quite difficult to distinguish the very smallest quantum bumps. So I think my computer's telling me I'll shut up now. Oh no, I've still got half my battery left. Sorry, I can carry on, I'm only halfway through now. So, okay. So, we think this might generalize to axons, synapses, and so on. And the way in which we want to develop this problem is, first of all, by looking in more detail at this noise, because that's obviously a very critical component. But the second way is by taking up on some of the points that have been raised in questions. So there's a question about how the optical performance of the eye might relate to the performance of the photoreceptor. And we started with the observation that if you look at something like the retina of the praying mantis, so the praying mantis has this wonderful big eye, and it has a region with big lenses which it uses to triangulate onto its prey. So it's at the front looking slightly inwards, and that's what it uses to get and catch the fly. And if you look at the length of the photoreceptors, where the lenses are small, the photoreceptors are short, and then the retina bulges out here and then goes back again. And if you look across a wide variety of diurnal insects, you find that photoreceptor length seems to correlate with the diameter of the lens. So our hypothesis is that the information capacity or maximum throughput of the photoreceptor is somehow matched to the amount of information that's made available to it from the lens. And this is something that, you know, in the days when people did photography with film and stuff, everybody knew that if you had a rubbishy camera with a useless little lens, it was a waste of money to buy a really good film. Conversely, if you spent hundreds of dollars on this fantastic Hasselblad, or thousands on Hasselblad, then you were very stupid if you went out and bought the cheapest film. You matched the quality of your receiver to the quality of the signal that it was getting. And at the moment, we're working with Dukla Stavinga, who's a great expert on optics, comparing lots of lenses of different sizes, both in different regions of the same eye and in different species, and comparing the optical performance with the ability of the photoreceptor to code information to see if that sort of matching principle applies. And then we want to extend that to look at the output synapse to see whether, again, the photoreceptors that provide more information are using a larger number of synapses to transmit it in order to average out the synaptic knowledge. And so that's going to be our program for the next 2 years, where us is me and Jeremy Niven and Dukla Stavinga. So there they are. Okay, that's it. So any comments and suggestions, greatly appreciated.
So I've kind of one question about the efficiency. It seems perhaps you might get better information per cost if the light gated channel had a lower conductance or smaller driving force. So for the same kind of signaling event, there are fewer ions that flow. Is it kind of possible to go in that direction, or is the conductance already as small as it can be compared to some other kind of noise limit?
There's all sorts of things come into play here. I mean, there's a suggestion, I think Marcus might know what the status of it is these days. It's a suggestion that originated with David Atwell and somebody else, that they observed that cone channels have a partial magnesium block, I think it is, which means that when they're activated, they only stay open for 0.1 of a millisecond or something. And they suggested in their paper that this allowed the cone to use a very large number of channels per photon, and therefore reduced some of the effects of channel noise. But it might also improve the metabolic efficiency. It depends a bit on the statistics of the block, but yeah.
Do you know how many ions, flow across one of these channels in a time constant of the membrane?
If you give me a piece of paper, I can send it out. Don't carry it around in my head, but yes, to a first approximation, we can work that out. Yeah. I mean, nobody's really looked at how you might tune the cascade for metabolic efficiency. That's something that just hasn't come up yet.
I thought Ames measured in rabbit retina that the transduction cascade actually contributed a significant amount of energy. The overall energy budget of the vertebrate photoreceptor goes down in high light because the ion current across the membrane goes down, but then there's a cost of the transduction machine that's a significant fraction of that.
So in Ames's experiment, the experiments on which are absolutely super experiments, where he put a rabbit retina into the heart-lung machine and was able to measure all the things you would like to measure, like rates of turnover of high energy phosphate, rates of utilization of oxygen, production of CO2, lactate, da da da. He could do it all. And he found that in the dark, about 40% of the energy consumption went into the rods. And when you put bright light on, that shut off, and then you got more consumption linked to neurotransmitters, because he could block synapses. But he also found that there was something like 30%, I think, of the energy consumption linked to high energy phosphate turnover that he couldn't attribute to anything. He was rather uncertain as to whether it was really involved in transduction or whether it was something else going on. So there is this mystery in the book. The only experiments we have at this level of detail in vertebrate retina as to how much phototransduction intermediates take. But there's another paper by the Italian group who work on rods, doing calculations based on the light-gated current in rods and knowledge of the phototransduction cascades. And their calculations suggest that phosphate turnover in the cascade is only about 10% of the pump activity. Although if you read the paper, it says that, but when you look at the numbers say the opposite, but then you discover that some Italian printer turned a micro into a milli, so.
So I remember maybe 10 years
ago or so, you gave a lecture in which you
said the same thing.
No. Some of the same things, but ended differently. The ending was that you know, while a fly's retina consumes perhaps a few percent of the resting fly's metabolism,
yeah,
it's only a 10 to the minus 4 of the flying fly's oxygen, yeah, consumption, and therefore one really ought to consider vision as an accessory system for flight and evaluate the cost, metabolic cost of the visual system only in the marginal increase over what it costs to fly.
Yeah.
Has your position changed on that?
Well, this is a very so this is a very difficult question, a very difficult point. So one thing we can do is actually take advantage of this and say, okay, when the fly is flying, the major cost of the retina is actually carrying it around. And you can calculate the masses of all of these components and attribute a cost to them, and that's what we intend to do. So this is the cost of carrying the camera as opposed to pointing at something and taking a picture. Now there's a lot of debate as to how long in the day flies actually fly, and that turns out in this sort of analysis to be rather important. But there's another much more serious unresolved problem, and that is a problem in evolutionary biology in general, that all organisms, or many organisms, have very expensive locomotory systems that when they're using them use large amounts of energy. And yet when you look at things like ears, which are, you know, using relatively little energy, or you look at lots of organs in the body whose energy consumption is quite small, nonetheless, they appear to be designed to be efficient. And so, from the point of view of energy consumption, or from the point of view of making best use of materials, so even making best use of cellular materials, the energy that you use in locomotion, you could be using that to synthesize bigger muscles or have a slightly larger kidney or something. And so it may be that the really, well, if you say this energy that I've invested in my muscles is vast compared with what I use on my eye, so therefore energy efficiency in the eye is negligible, implies that if you saved on energy in the eye, you wouldn't be able to do anything useful with it. But if you did something like make it into eggs and sperm, for example, that actually might bring you quite a big benefit. And so it all boils down to questions about marginal costs. It's like a corporation has a giant factory, turns out, you know, uses huge amounts of money to produce something, and the marginal profit might be 5%. And then the marginal cost of the back office or the sales staff, which is small compared with the cost of production.
In a sense, that's the calculation one wants to do, right?
That's the sort of calculation one wants to do. And I
mean, if I spend more energy on the eye, I might be able, yeah, to chart a more efficient flight path and, yeah, and save 500 times that by flying straight.
What you would really like to do is try and link energy consumption in the eye to fitness. And we just finished a 3-year project looking at this in Drosophila. And it looks like the eye in Drosophila is too small and the energy consumption is too low for us to get a really measurable, robust effect in laboratory populations of Drosophila. So, but we are trying to go down that line.
You're trying to do it by mutating?
So what we did was, this is an idea that actually came from Joe Howard, that there's a mutation called TRP which disables the photoreceptors. It seems to be, well, it disables one of the light-gating channels. And TRP was discovered in flies, and the phenotype is that when you put on a bright light, you get a vigorous response for about a second, and then it decays away, and from there on after, you don't get anything, because it can't recharge its calcium stores or something. And so this is a mutation that shuts photoreceptors off in bright light. And what Joe discovered was that in Califera, or actually in these cilia, if you have a white-eyed mutant. So the white-eyed mutant has no optics, essentially, because the light can leak from one ometidium to another. So the photoreceptors are useless. And in a white-eyed population, TRP has a very high penetrance because it's saving energy wastage in this useless photoreceptor. And we thought we could do the same thing in Drosophila and then harness all of other wonderful mutants that you had in Drosophila to look at this. But in Drosophila, the experiment simply doesn't work.
Because it doesn't make any difference in them.
It doesn't seem to make it. We don't know why. It may be something to do with the length that the Drosophila has been in culture. Most of the Lucilia stocks, not the white-eyed ones, but many other, they haven't been in culture as long as maybe the Drosophila's got everything sussed out for living in milk bottles and really, you know, wasting energy on your eye doesn't matter very much.
So what exactly was the measurement you did there?
So what we tried to do was to measure the penetrance of, just as Joe had done, measure the penetrance of the TRP in the Drosophila population by essentially using PCR to find out the number of the proportion of Drosophila that had this transcript. That's the way you'd like to go.
Yeah.
You can think of something to do on mice, that would be.
Yeah, sure. So I think, yeah, it is the way you want to go, and here's why it bothers me, why it's so hard to go that way. What's the value of not getting swatted?
A lot, because you don't get to reproduce at all if you get swatted.
Yeah.
And so then you really, there's incredible value in responding fast, seeing fast,
yeah,
flying quickly. A horse is swishing its tail. So it's very, 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 very hard to value. You know, we all like Shannon information.
Yeah.
But when push comes to shove, which is inclusive fitness, is what we're trying to do, is push comes to shove. It's real tough to make that translation.
You don't want bits, you actually want something.
You want to stay alive.
You want to stay alive.
You want to reproduce.
Well, I think I'm a challenge. Argue at this level that Shannon information is increasing the speed of response, so it kind of helps. It doesn't actually deal with latency. You can wait forever for the message, and there's no penalty in Shannon information. I agree with that, but it's kind of related. Yes, so one would like to see how this energy investment helps you deal with a biologically meaningful stimulus, which is why we just reconstructed the signal of generated by one fly on the photoreceptor mosaic, another fly, from data where flies were chasing each other to mate. Yeah. And what we would like to do, that was done in house flies. Unfortunately, Drosophila buzz their wings at each other to recognize each other for mating, and they don't use vision very much. I mean, if somebody can think of a way of interfering with housefly photoreceptors, we're hoping that sort of RNAi or something might help us somewhere down the line. But none of the genetic techniques from Drosophila have transferred very well into other flies so far. So, okay.
Yeah.